is Monday, February 20th. We're going to be wrapping up the skin information today.
Okay, so what are some issues when someone experiences a skin burn? Fluid loss, definitely. Okay, so skin covers like 20 square feet of your body's surface area, and if you're losing skin due to a burn, one of the major things we're concerned about now is losing fluids to the environment. What are some things that help to keep your skin dry? Keratin, good. What type of cell makes keratin? Keratinocytes, yeah. Keratinocytes, good. And are they in the epidermis or the dermis? Epidermis, good. Now, in addition to keratinocytes, there's also a type of junction that prevents fluid loss normally. And this particular junction is a spot weld, literally welding one cell to the neighboring cell. What kind of junction is this? Well, desmosomes do weld together cells, and then also tight junctions. So junctions also help to keep us waterproofed in addition to keratin. And the simple fact that we have many, many layers of our epidermis also helps to keep us waterproofed. So losing skin means that we lose the ability to keep ourselves waterproofed. Another issue is loss of protective covering. You know, like I mentioned, 20-something square feet of your body is covered by skin. That's a lot of surface area that needs protection and, you know, kind of a dry outermost protective shell or layer. So what are some things about your skin that inhibit microbe infections? White blood cells, good. What are the names of the specific white blood cells that patrol your skin? Langerhans, good. So Langerhans patrol, okay. Oil is also an antibiotic because it's acid and it prevents bacteria from growing on your skin. So that's another issue here that we look for in helping us to have infections due to microbes. This is a serious one as well. Severe burns can cause cell denaturation and cell death. So denaturation occurs specifically with proteins. What does denatured protein mean? Breakdown, yeah, so it's changed shape. It no longer can function like it should. So denatured proteins are certainly a big issue for those who have had a skin burn. So we want to keep these in mind as we think about the issues associated with severe burns. And I wanted to share with you just briefly this thing called the Rule of Nines. Okay, and it, by the way, is at the bottom of your page. So this Rule of Nines divides your body into 9% regions. You'll notice the front and back of the body, each is 18%. The front of each arm is 4.5%. The back of each arm is 4.5%. So that totals 9%. You'll notice the front of each leg is 9%. The back of each leg is 9%. So if you just kind of think about the math here, the body is basically divided into regions that are covered by 9% of your skin. So that's where the Rule of Nines comes from. Now, on your worksheet there, you'll notice that you've got about 11 areas for this Rule of Nines. A very small portion goes to the perineum, and actually a small portion goes to the head. So a serious burn can affect percentages, and we can count how much the percentage has been affected by a burn. So let's go back up and talk about degrees of skin burns. And I wanted to mention that there's more to burning the skin than simply a sunburn. What are some other things that can burn the skin?
Fire,
definitely.
Chemicals.
Electricity.
Water.
Hot water, yeah. So anytime you burn the skin, you promote the inflammatory process. Thinking back, what are the four major cardinal signs of inflammation?
Redness, swelling, heat, pain.
Good. Redness, swelling, heat, and pain. So when we think about these types of burns, we're going to see the signs of inflammation, the redness, the swelling, the heat, and the pain. There's a first degree burn in this picture all the way to a fourth degree burn. There is no such thing as a zero degree or fifth degree burn. So our numbers here rank from 1 to 4. Now, the layers that are affected go deeper into the skin. So a first degree burn only affects the superficial epidermis. You'll notice a second degree burn may affect the entirety of the epidermis, the upper portions of the dermis, and may affect as low as the deeper portions of the dermis as well. We tend to call these a full thickness burn if they affect both layers of the epidermis. You'll notice a third degree burn not only affects the two epidermis and dermal layers of the skin, but we've also now burned down into the hypodermis. Is the hypodermis considered part of your skin?
No.
Not technically, right? So we're now affecting that underlying connective tissue, and a fourth degree burn goes four levels deep, and that's now down into underlying muscle tissue. It could be bone tissue or even cartilage. So the catch here is, the epidermis is considered your first layer or first degree. Dermis is the second layer or second degree. The hypodermis is three layers down, a third degree, and muscle tissue is four layers down. That would be a fourth degree. So if you think of it in those terms of how many layers we've burned or affected through some kind of chemical or hot water or whatnot, then we're just counting how many layers down into the body are being affected. So let me show you some pictures of first degree burns. These are what we think of as, you know, simple sunburns. They're of course inflammation that results. That's where the redness comes from. These tend to not be very serious. These heal with little more than some pain involved. But since it only affects the superficial portion of the skin, there's not a lot of long-term damage here. So what particular region of the skin is damaged when you have a first degree burn? Epidermis, right. So just the epidermis here is damaged. When you have a second degree burn, what two layers are now affected? Yeah, epidermis and dermis. It may be superficial dermis. It may also be the deep portions of the dermis. Now, there is a big characteristic that distinguishes first degree from second degree burns. What would you look for to confirm that you have a second degree burn?
Blisters,
exactly. So you can see some blisters, pretty bad looking blisters here. We've all heard don't pop the blister, because if you pop the blister, what can you now do?
Infection,
right. So we know that's a big issue with burns, is to introduce infection. So this picture has a combination of two different kinds of burns. You've got some second degree burns here, and you've got some third degree burns. Third degree burns may appear chalky white, or they may in fact appear black and charred. So the third degree burns in this picture are this region through here. So third degree burns are rather serious, because what layers are now affected?
Epidermis.
Right. Epidermis, dermis, hypodermis. So this is a completely full thickness of the skin that you have damaged. And is there any opportunity for regrowth of skin if you burn down into the hypodermis?
No.
So unfortunately, this is where we really start seeing those problems, such as loss of sensation, fluid loss. We can't regrow the skin without skin grafting. We have difficulty with the stretchiness of the skin when you burn through all three layers. So this thick layer burn here, this full thickness burn, is going to affect down into the hypodermis. Would you expect this person to have any pain around the areas that are third degree burns?
Mm-hmm.
Not in the third degree burn. Now, these are second degree burns, so would they have pain there?
Yes.
Yeah, pain in the second degree areas, which are bright red in this picture, but in the areas that are third degree burns, there should be no pain. So why is there no pain associated with a third degree burn? Yeah, you killed the nerve. So epidermis, dermis, hypodermis burn the nerve endings off, and it's unlikely for them to regrow. Okay, so these are some third degree burns as well. Yeah, that's pretty nasty looking. So it can be white and ashen in color. It can be black and charred like you see in this picture.
You know what kind of burn that is?
I don't. I'm guessing it's probably electrical or something. Probably not sunburn.
Well, it's probably electrical because the skin's peeled out. Something's
yeah.
Exited.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
That looks like really painful.
It does look painful.
Yeah. Especially this wouldn't hurt, but this would hurt.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Yeah.
Electrical. Just amputate that. Just right. Call it a day.
Just take it off.
Take that off, yeah. And this is also very bad. This is a fourth degree burn, and you'll notice it affects epidermis, dermis, hypodermis, and underlying muscle tissue. And believe it or not, that is a hot water burn. Yeah.
Wow.
So, you know, the point here is skin grafts can do some good if you've got like a third degree burn, but you can't skin graft on top of something that's also dead tissue. That muscle tissue there is dead. So they would have to provide muscle grafting as well. When they take skin grafts, they take it from areas like your buttocks or your back, and you know there's a lot of skin back there, so they can simply replace these areas. It may be viable with some new skin, but yeah, that in that case there, that's probably a much more serious issue.
That will shave your teeth and take scalp skin.
Scalp skin.
Yes, ma'am. Both my boys were burned one day. We're 10 months old, 21 months old. One was on his back. They did use buttocks, but they eventually ended up shaving their heads when a lot of the grass wouldn't take. So they used the scalp skin to do the ones that would not take.
Oh, interesting.
Yes, ma'am.
Now, where they put that skin, did it grow hair like the scalp?
Where the third degree burns are, I mean.
Okay.
My son has second degree burns. That's the deep second degree on the top of his head. He has hair that's grown back in certain places, but for the most part, he's bald.
Wow.
And the places, like, on the side of his face and his eyebrows, he has, like, they grow sometimes kind of long. Sometimes they're very curly where it's, you know, it's burnt past the oils and stuff where it's really dry. And they are very curly, but for the most part, no. Because my youngest son has burns all down the front of his legs. He does not have hair.
Wow.
And he has places on his chest and his belly. He does not have hair. My other son, where it was his back, he doesn't have hair on his arms where he was burned. He doesn't have hair.
Wow.
So for the most part, no. When they take the skin off, it damages their sweat glands. So you have to watch for them overheating. And because they've been and taken the places on multiple places on multiple times, it's only 1/3 of a millimeter thick before they mesh it, but they will go back like after 2 or 3 weeks and take that skin in to do the ones that didn't take or the ones that they could not do.
Wow. Interesting how even as young as they were, there's not the plasticity with the skin as we have with other body parts.
And the places where they have done the skin grafts, they have to always go and have those released because they don't stretch. They contract. And they will put new grafts in, full thickness grafts. They will go in and do Z-place and change the scar direction. But for the most part, as they grow, they told me until they stop growing, but it's not because their stuff is on joints and different places. They'll have to have that for the rest of their life.
Wow. Wow. You don't think about that being babies, you know.
Well, even after they had like a lot of the stuff done, they go and see a plastic surgeon now. And the plastic surgeon's done a lot of stuff. It's been 16 years ago this June, and now it starts to, the scar tissue from the grafts and stuff starts to affect the underlying muscle and the soft tissue that's under there.
Wow.
So they still continue to have issues with that no matter how old it is. So
wow.
That is a lot.
Interesting stuff. Thank you for sharing that. This might be interesting to you guys. There's something called a skin gun. Have you ever heard of this before? Okay. I don't have speakers in here that we can hook into, but I'd like to show you parts of the video just so you can see how the skin gun works. Let me give you the background to it because it's relevant in situations where you have, say, second, third degree burns. You know, the way this was invented was a lot of people coming back from Afghanistan and Iraq are coming home with severe burns that need immediate treatment. So this skin gun takes your own stem cells. It grows them in a laboratory to, you know, replicate them, make more of them. And then they put them in what looks like a little gun that sprays like an airbrush onto your body, these stem cells. So they're actually seeing results occur where skin grows back within days rather than what they you know, run into with skin grafts, which it may take, it may not take. Of course, the downside of doing skin grafts is, like you mentioned, scar tissue and things of that sort. With this skin gun, they've got a guy who had a severe burn on his shoulder, and they'll show his shoulder. You won't even know that he had ever been burned there. Those skin cells that were sprayed onto that area took root and regrow, and there's absolutely no marking that you can see whatsoever. So for some reason, it hasn't really taken off, but from what they've been doing, it seems to work. It's pretty cool stuff. Let's see, that's gone back. What's gone on those topics?
Skin is the largest organ in the body.
So I know you can't hear
and
it,
when it's severely burned,
fast forward you a little bit here. So they took that guy's hand. You could see how it was like massively cracked open with like some infection perhaps. And that's the skin gun. And they loaded up with stem cells from your own body, which means, you know, practically no rejection rate. And they sprayed across the burned area or the damaged area. And this is the guy here that had some severe burns. And of course, he's all healed now, but when they show his shoulder had received some second and third degree burns. They use that skin gun, no grafting required, and then of course that grew back with no problem. I think it was like from Friday to Monday, he had experienced complete regrowth of that arm.
That's crazy.
Yeah. Why we don't do this everywhere, I don't know. Let's see, I'm trying to find you the picture of his shoulder. So it looks like completely normal skin. You'd never know anything happened to him. Yeah, that link is in this PowerPoint if you guys would like to listen to it. I hate there's no speakers in here. But it's a great, great video if you'd like to take a look at it. Yes, yeah, skin gun.
It's on
the
PowerPoint?
It's on the PowerPoint, or you can just go to YouTube and look up the skin gun. Nat Geo. So speaking of issues that affect the skin, let's turn our attention from burns to cancers. Let me flip you on over to page 62. So a lot of times when cells in the skin are exposed to things in the environment, the DNA in those cells may change. Now, where it matters is where cells are reproducing. Let's think about your epidermis. Which layer of your skin in the epidermis experiences new growth?
Basal.
Basal, good. So that deepmost basal layer may be affected from sunlight, may be affected by chemicals. So whatever you may be exposed to that comes into contact with your stratum basal can alter the DNA in those cells. And unfortunately, if those cells are permanently altered, then they become cancerous. So you can see that normal cells listen to controls of their DNA as to when they're to divide and when they're not to divide. But cancerous cells have damaged DNA. They may be starting the cell reproduction process, and then they may not turn it off. So unfortunately, that just means that these immature cells with crazy amounts of DNA may get pumped out, and these cells don't listen to the message that says, hey, shut off, we're done making new cells. So that's how tumors can grow, is when that DNA gets damaged or altered. You probably have heard the terms benign versus malignant before. Where is a benign tumor?
You said what is it?
Yeah, what is it or where is it? Right, that's a cancer that hasn't yet spread. It may be simply called a tumor. But if it spreads to other cells and tissues, now what should we call it?
Malignant.
Metastasized or malignant, right. Most of these cancers have oma endings. You'll notice in the list there that carcinomas are specific to epithelial tissues. What do adenocarcinomas affect? Glands, yeah. A couple of years ago, I had a student in class, and she had salivary gland cancer. And it's a slow-growing cancer, which was to her benefit because she had not had all of it removed. So, you know, you wouldn't imagine having salivary gland cancer, but she had felt some hardness in one of her salivary glands. And it's in a very delicate place. Your salivary glands are on the sides here, up under your chin, up under the jawline, and under your tongue. So that's a very painful area to have those salivary glands cut out. But glandular cancer, like salivary cancer, is classified as an adenocarcinoma. What do sarcomas affect? Good, that's bone, muscle tissue. Now, you oftentimes don't hear about too many sarcomas. Why is that? Does muscle tissue like to grow and repair itself? Not really. Yes, so muscle tissue, like skeletal muscle, tends to grow at a very slow rate. It doesn't like to repair itself. Therefore, you're not going to find too many people with sarcomas that affect skeletal muscle tissue. Bone is hard to invade with tumors as well. So bone cancer, the actual bone itself, is also hard to get a cancer evolved in. It happens, of course, but it's not like other tissues that are faster growing. What do lymphomas affect? Lymph nodes, right. And lymph nodes are scattered under your chin, they're in your armpit area, in your groin. That's just a few of their locations. And they're typically cleaning the fluids in your body that are called lymph, that are passing back to your bloodstream, so they can pick up cancer cells too. Finally, what do leukemias affect? Blood. Okay, so emia, that suffix there, emia means blood cancer. So we know that there's a whole host of different kinds of white blood cells, so they tend to be most affected by the leukemias. Also, they're the ones that fight infection, or at least that should be their job. I'd like to focus out of this list on the carcinomas, since they're the ones that affect our epithelial tissues. And I wanted to show you this picture of cancer deaths in the U.S. This is from 2016. You'll notice that out of all of these cancers here, almost all of them are epithelial tissue cancers. The number one, lung and bronchial cancer, is epithelial. That affects the simple squamous or small cells in between those simple squamous tissues in the lungs. Prostate, colon, and rectum cancer. Pancreatic cancer, these are all epithelial tissue cancers. Finally, we reach leukemia, which is a blood cancer, and then we go back to esophageal, which is epithelial in nature. Bladder cancer is epithelial in nature, and then we come back to another blood or immune system type cancer. So you can see that there's a whole bunch of cancers up here that are associated with epithelial tissues. So why epithelial among all four tissue types? Fast reproduction, right. So that is a quick growing tissue. It needs to repair itself quickly. So if you introduce some kind of mutation in there, maybe from exposure to cigarette smoke, for instance, or hair dye, if you're a hairdresser, those kinds of things can cause, of course, lung cancer, or hair dyes can cause bladder cancer. So all these kinds of chemicals in our environment that we're exposed to can kind of speed up the process of mutations in that DNA. So kind of a scary, sobering thought when you look at this and say, okay, if you're a female, your chance of forming some type of cancer in your lifetime is about a 33% chance. That's a really sobering thought. For females, you have a 1 in 8 chance of developing breast cancer, a 1 in 17 chance of lung cancer, and so forth. If you're a male, you have a 50% chance of developing cancer at some point in your lifetime. And the most likely one to form would be prostate cancer. But there's actually good news there. That's one of the easiest ones to treat and the ones that you can live with for the longest period of time. So that's actually a kind of not such a bad news, I guess, if you were to get the cancer news. And then, of course, 5-year survival rates here. breast cancer has great survival rates compared to other cancer types. Why do you think that is? What's that?
We can remove the breast.
Can remove the breast, right? Take it completely out. What are some other reasons you think breast cancer has a good survival rate?
You can regrow it.
Detect it easily. Yeah. So if you can detect it easily, most likely, you know, we might do something about it if you know it's there in the first place. A lot of these other cancers are hard to detect. Ovarian cancer and pancreatic cancer have very low survival rates simply because they're hard to detect. So we do know that changes in smell, how weird is that, is one of the signs of ovarian cancer. And pancreatic cancer may be detectable with some new tests that have been developed lately. But otherwise, you know, those are extremely hard to detect, and if you let it metastasize, then now you have a greater problem to deal with. So I'd like to take you through three types of cancers. The first one is a basal cell carcinoma. The word carcinoma tells us what's being affected.
Skin.
Yep. So this is a skin cancer. So if you take a close look at this picture, do you see the basal cell carcinoma? Okay, so let's see, that's epidermis, right? Okay, and then we expect from this point down to find dermis. But all of this stuff in here, all of that is basal cell carcinoma. So basal cell carcinoma does start in stratum basal, like the name implies, but it can push down into that underlying dermis. So it's not that it necessarily grows out like a mole or a tumor on the outer surface. It's there, but the deepest portions may be reaching down further towards your dermis layers. When they take off a basal cell carcinoma, they do what's called Mohs surgery. Not Mohs like the restaurant Mohs, but M-O-H surgery. And they'll slice, like taking a bad spot out of an apple, and they'll look under a microscope to see if any cancerous cells exist. If they do, they come back and like a bad apple, they take another scrape deep, and they keep scraping until they get all clean edges on the sample that they take off. So in this piece, they would have to take all the way down below and around to completely remove that portion that's been cancerized. Now, they can do skin grafts on a place like this because that's going to leave quite a hole on the skin, and hopefully the skin graft will take in a place where you've had a basal cell carcinoma removed. You can see these tend to affect the older population. They tend to run in families, so there must be a genetic component to them as well. And how would you know you had a basal cell carcinoma just by looking at these kinds of places?
It's not normal looking.
It's not normal looking, right. So one of the things they see with this is a spot that doesn't heal, that bleeds and scabs, and then it bleeds and scabs. And it bleeds and scabs. And if you pay attention, it's been doing this for a month or two or 6 months. And unfortunately, that's the sign of a basal cell carcinoma. It's something that bleeds and scabs and bleeds and scabs and never fully heals itself. This is a basal cell carcinoma that has spread. That certainly looks like it's something that should not belong. Another basal cell carcinoma here on the eyelid. And here's one that's grown out of control. Maybe the person just ignored it. Maybe they didn't know what it was. But that's certainly a much larger problem to deal with now. Imagine cutting that out.
Nope.
And this is on the scalp.
What?
Yeah.
This must came off Google because they always show the worst pictures.
They do. Well, these are very. These are starting with the least problematic to the worst cases. This one came from UC San Diego. Yeah. So imagine, you know, 100, 200 years ago before we had modern medicine, you probably would have encountered a lot of people walking around, especially older people. We didn't have ways to remove these kinds of things and no way to graft back skin. So, you know, you just kind of sat with it and hoped that it didn't cause any problems. These are slow to metastasize, so you know, you do have some time with them, but you don't want to probably sit and let them get this big. This is a woman's face. You can see So your eyes right there, and all of that is basal cell carcinoma. So yeah, that's devastating, because how would you graft all of that? Let's talk about squamous cell carcinoma. This particular type affects not necessarily stratum basal, but the actively dividing keratinocytes. And so squamous cell carcinoma tends to see little flaky dry places start to form. That's not a surprise, because what do keratinocytes make?
Waterproofing.
Keratin, yeah, waterproofing your skin. So it may start as a scaly portion of your skin. It may not look like a whole lot, but then it continues to enlarge.
So with the basal, what would be something that you want us to actually remember about that?
It affects stratum basal. That's the main thing. Okay. Whereas this one affects keratinocytes.
Gotcha.
Sometimes melanocytes can get hooked up in this drama, and you'll notice that these two squamous cell carcinomas actually have some coloration to them. These growths here obviously don't appear normal. We're just continuing to look at more and worse cases of these. Now, the third of our types of skin cancer is called melanoma, and melanomas are the most dangerous type because they're at the highest risk for metastasis. What does that mean?
Spread,
right. So this is the deadliest form of skin cancer. This is why we should strip down naked and look in front of the mirror, either with help or without, at least once a year. So getting your moles and freckles checked out is worthwhile, especially if you've had some sun exposure. Skincancer.org has a lot of information if you want a trustworthy place to look up more info on skin cancer. So melanoma, of course, comes from melanocytes that have become cancerous. What do melanocytes do? Make melanin, right. So you can, of course, see the link between sun exposure or tanning bed exposure and cancer in those melanocytes. Instead of reading this A, B, C, D, E rule to you, I'd like to show you how to spot these malignant or these dangerous melanomas. So the first letter of the A is looking at the symmetry or asymmetry of a mole or freckle on your body. On the left-hand side, you have a normal mole, and the left and the right sides more or less look like they're mirror images of each other. But asymmetrical moles do not. They have two sides that do not match each other, so they've lost their symmetry. B stands for border irregularity. The mole on the left is more or less smooth along its edges, but the mole on the right looks like it has these strange little outcroppings of growth. That's another warning sign of a melanoma. Coloration should be uniform. You should have a mole or a freckle that is brown or black, but it shouldn't be two-toned or blue in color or blue and black or brown and black. It shouldn't be mixtures of colors. That is another warning sign of a melanoma. So what is a diameter that is a caution for us? What size are we looking for? If it's grown, yes, 6 millimeters, which is a pencil eraser size. Yeah, it's about the size of the tip of your pinky. So something that's that large indicates that mole has grown or perhaps has been enlarging. And that is sometimes why we use letter E. E for enlarging or an evolving type of mole or freckle. I have heard that the general rule of thumb is to look for your ugly ducklings. If you have a mole or freckle that tends to stand out and doesn't look like the others on your body, they say that is one to have checked out. So a dermatologist or another type of physician can look at those for you and take a sample if needed or a biopsy. So you can see this person had several types of moles or freckles, and then this one stands out because of several reasons. What's wrong with that one?
It's too big.
It's too big. It looks like it's spreading.
Colors
are off. Border doesn't look like it's necessarily smooth, and it's also asymmetrical, which means the left and the right sides don't match up. So that pretty much violates all 5 rules of what we look for with a melanoma. Here's one on the eyelid. Interesting thing about melanoma, it is oftentimes found on sun-exposed skin surfaces. That could be, of course, being outside or from tanning bed exposure, but it doesn't always have to be on sun-exposed surfaces, as is evidenced by the picture on the bottom left. That is penis cancer. That's a melanoma there. We'll look at something a little less off than that. How does this one fit the A, B, C, D, E rule?
It's not asymmetrical.
Border's not smooth. Kind of different colors, yeah. We can't really tell about the diameter or if it's changing in size, but it certainly fits the A, B, C portion of that rule. So unfortunately, if left untreated, melanoma can metastasize and spread. And so this looks like a case where you've got it popping up in tumors elsewhere in the body.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, just awful.
Older people.
I mean, I know, they just...
It's okay, it'll pass.
Yeah.
And then it's like this big, and
or they don't have insurance.
Yeah.
Or it costs too much.
And this is interesting. This came out about a year or so ago in Japan. There was a man who had melanoma on his gums, of all places to have melanoma, because that's such a thin layer of skin over the top of the mandible and maxilla. So all of that up there, that is melanoma.
What, from not brushing their teeth?
It's just...
So what would they do in that situation? It's not like you can just go in there and just...
I don't know if they did radiation on him, because like you said, I don't know if they could take that out. And there's not a lot of tissue there in the first place. Yeah.
Lose his teeth?
Yeah, seriously. I think they were probably doing like radiation and chemo.
He looked like he smoked.
I'm not sure if that would have
anything.
Yeah, I don't know if it would cause that case, that bad of a case, but that's pretty awful. And this is an X-sized melanoma. You can see it's about 4 centimeters. An inch is 2.5 centimeters, so that's well over an inch in size. Looks like it's well over an inch in depth too, so pretty big melanoma that's been cut out. Okay, so that should take us down to the bottom of the page. Do you have any question on skin burns or skin cancers? Tumor, and I don't know if you can see the ruler, but it's 6 inches. Yeah. Did she have weight gain or blood pressure problems?
I don't know. I just know she felt sick and felt like pressure and pain down there. And I actually thought that it had spread.
Yeah.
To other places when I got in there, it looked like it was fairly localized.
Wow. I heard it's localized. That's huge.
Yes. That was kind of shocked.
I mean, that's pretty. Serious stuff.
Yeah. How you wouldn't see it protruding out, my God.
Unless it just crowded something else out inside.
They said it just put a ton of pressure and stuff on other organs, so it was literally just shutting everything out of the way.
She's pretty lucky to have that taken out. Mm-hmm. Wow.
Wow.
Mm. Talk about bad stuff, you know. Wow.
That looks like this is the size of a small piece.
Seriously. It's like a softball sized. Yeah. Wow. All right, we are ready to begin bones. Before we go there, I'd like to take you through a quick review. number one, what layer of the epidermis houses melanocytes?
Basal.
Basal, good. Is that the topmost or the bottommost layer?
Bottommost,
good. So stratum basal houses melanocytes. Number two, what two tissues are found in the dermis? What kind of connective tissues?
Okay. It's irregular.
And could be adipose, but more likely it could be loose.
Areolar.
Yeah, so loose areolar is in that upper papillary region. The bottom portion, known as the reticular layer of the dermis, is dense irregular. And if you keep on going, the hypodermis down below is loose adipose.
So the stratified is loose areolar, dense irregular?
Yes. And then loose adipose, and then probably muscle tissue. Yeah. So why can we say a person is cyanotic? We know that they are missing what?
Oxygen.
Good. So no, not if oxygen perfusing to cells and tissues gets you a blue tint. And we'll talk about in Bio-211, there's never actually a time when you got blue blood, but of course it looks like that.
It
just means that your hemoglobin doesn't have enough oxygen. Yeah. So what could be the organ problem behind jaundice? Good. And or? Gallbladder. Yeah, liver and or gallbladder. But most likely liver, right? What are dermal papillae? Good. Connect epidermis to the dermis. And of course, what forms them is the upper layer of your dermis known as?
Loose areolar,
right? And it's that papillary layer that's groovy. How many strata are in the palm or epidermis? Are there four layers there or five layers there?
Five
layers, good. So from the top down, they are stratum corneum.
That's the one about the...
Corny Lucy's, Grandma's, Billiam's, yeah. So corneum, lucidum, Grandma, granulosum, spinosum, and then basal. That's it.
So you might want to ask us to order?
I would definitely ask you to order, yeah. And I'll ask you where has an extra layer. Just palms and soles has lucidum. Everywhere else has only four layers. What allows for growth of your hair root? Hair follicle. Yep, hair follicle, good. And by the way, do you know what type of tissue or what layer of the epidermis forms that hair follicle? What layer of your epidermis forms that hair follicle? Stratum basal, yep. Stratum basal, good.
Because it's got to go all the way through that and follicle growing and there's no more hair.
Correct, exactly right. And finally, the function of Eckrin's sudoriferous glands is to make
sweat.
Yeah. Yes. But this isn't the kind of sweat that's in your armpit. This is sweat that does what? Cools you down. Cool, yeah. Exactly. So you can find Eckrin's sweat glands all over your body surface. The specific type of sweat gland in your armpits and groin are not Eckrin. They're called apocrine, right? So they're always associated with hairs. Anybody still need the slide? So I'd like to get you started with the skeletal system. We're going to flip on over to page 63. So we're going to start off by talking about skeletal system functions. Let me give you a moment to jot down these five jobs on the top of page 63. Number one is support, number two, protection, and so forth. So interesting stuff about your skeleton. Your skeleton actually replaces itself about 6 times in your lifetime. You know, we oftentimes have this idea that it's a static internal framework that doesn't change. You grow up with it, you feed it with calcium and dairy products, and then there it is, it's set up for life. But in fact, over 6 times in your lifetime, we're going to completely recycle and rebuild our bones. So that gives us the idea that these are very much living organs. They are certainly a part of your body that you can influence through diet and exercise. So in terms of function, our number one job here is to provide support. And that's not only support for your body as an upright framework, but also provide support for the attachment of tissues and internal organs. So we use this as a framework to basically anchor all of those other soft tissues. It's also hard to talk about protection without talking about the other muscles here. Muscles and bones do a lot together. But we can look specifically at a couple of body cavities that are really well protected by bones. On the front side, we have our ventral body cavity. The ventral body cavity has 2 portions. What is the portion provided by your rib cage?
Thoracic,
good. What organs are inside the rib cage? Heart and lungs, good. What is the lower cavity?
Domino
pelvic, good. Not a lot of bony protection there. Some is provided by the lower ribs and the pelvic bones, but otherwise there's not a whole lot of bony protection there. On the back side, we have another body cavity. This one is called what? Dorsal, good. And of course the skull provides a cavity known as?
Cranial.
And the brain in there. And then inside our spinal cord, or of course inside our vertebrae is our spinal cord, another place for bony protection. So there is a lot of protection here provided by bones, a little bit by muscle, but that of course isn't as protective as the rib cage and other bony portions. Movement, another big job. Do bones move by themselves?
No.
So what pulls bones?
Muscles,
right. So we kind of have to look at bones and muscles working together to provide movement. So that'll be a topic we continue to explore in the next chapter. Let's talk about storage. What kinds of minerals are stored in your bones?
Calcium.
Phosphorus. Good. Big one, of course, being calcium. Phosphorus is also important. Back when we began this course, we talked a little bit about phosphates and phosphorus groups. Can you tell me what type of organic molecule is built from phosphate groups? DNA, RNA, ATP. Good. Yeah, so we get some phosphate groups that are stored here in these bones. Good. So keep in mind, it's not just calcium, it's also phosphorus. And on the interior of our bones, we have a hollow cavity, and that's where we store fatty tissue. So this particular fatty tissue is called marrow, and that's not necessarily weight that you need to lose, which is good news. This marrow in here has actually got a completely different function, and its function is number 5, blood cell formation. So blood cell formation, or hematopoiesis, occurs in the long bone cavities. It also occurs in the spongy bone cavities at the ends of our long bones. I do want to point out that there's 2 types of marrow. There's red marrow and yellow marrow. The active marrow cavity that produces new blood cells is called red marrow. Yellow mirror, by the way, is not active anymore producing new cells. It only stores fatty tissue. So I'll be sure to mention those later. They're actually detailed for us in another page. Okay. So red mirror is the only one actively involved in making blood cells. Yellow mirror is simply for storage. All right, let me pause another time and give you a moment to jot down these six bone shapes. Oh, I have not. Thank you for reminding me. So you probably have seen this in Bio-110, maybe in lab, talk about those bone shapes. We can classify bones by their predominant shape or overall shape. And the first four are really easy because the name describes what you're looking for. When we're talking about long bones, we're talking about bones that are longer than they are wide. And these are the ones in our appendicular skeleton. So in the upper arm, we've got the humerus, we've got ulna and radius. In the hand, we also have metacarpals and
phalanges.
Yes, so metacarpals in the palm and phalanges making up your finger. Down here in the leg, we've got femur, tibia, and fibula. Good. What else in the foot? Metatarsals and phalanges. I bet you can't do that with your leg, right? So we've got a number of long bones. They're longer than they are wide. They tend to have a shaft, and they tend to have ends, all of that covered with a smooth type of bone called compact bone. The short bones are, like the name implies, they are short and square in nature, and those short bones are commonly found in the wrist areas as carpals. And where else can you find them? And your foot as tarsals, right. So keep in mind, T for toes, T for tarsals, that's all in the foot together. You drive your car with your carpals, so of course those carpals are in your hands. A lot of times we classify the patella as a short bone, but I'll tell you why we also classify it as the sesamoid in just a moment. All right, next type is a flat bone. And I know you're thinking here, flat like a table or flat like a book, but in fact, our flat bones are curved. Now, that doesn't really kind of hold true with the name, right? It's kind of a little bit of a lie. What you expect, though, with the flat bone is a sandwich. Two layers on the outside of compact bone, and a sandwich inside where the meat is found of spongy bone. So if you're to feel one of these ribs, if you were to feel the skull bones, even the sternum, they're all constructed in the same way. They're not round like a straw, they are flat and curved, and they're all built with this sandwich technique. Well, when you don't know what to do with a bone, you put it in the irregular category. These have no rhyme or reason to their shape, so into the irregular category we place vertebrae. What else might you put there? Coxal bones, good, what else? Mandible you could put there, maybe scapula, and those are regular categories. Okay, so those tend to have no rhyme or reason to their shape. They don't fall into long, short, or the flat categories, so we stick them in the irregular category. They say that we have 206 bones, but I bet you if we were to count everybody in this room, we would come up with just a few of us with 206, and everybody else would have some variety more or less than that. And the reason for the variety of numbers of bones is due to this. These are called sutural bones. Where are they located?
Skull.
Skull, yeah. So every place those major bones come together, you have the potential for forming these little tiny sutural bones. So this person might have 215 bones if we were to count all of their sutural bones. And another reason that we say on average we have 206 is because of sesamoid bones. The patella is a great example. Most of us have a patella. It usually forms by age 1. I did say most of us have a patella. Not everybody forms one of these because it's considered a sesamoid bone. It is literally grown through by ligaments and tendons that hold it into place, and that's the nature of any sesamoid bone. It grows inside of a ligament or a tendon. You may have them in your wrist, your elbow, your knees, of course, like the patella here, and you may have multiples of these sesamoid bones. So if you had an x-ray done, they might reveal that you had many sesamoids sitting in those joints. But they're normally held in place by those ligaments and tendons. Okay, do you have any questions on these bone types? Could you tell me a description plus an example come test time? Okay, you got a week to get there, right? All right, page 64 is a practice page. Let me take you over to page 65. Yeah. Not necessarily essay, that page, but it will be definitely multiple choice. And I may give you a picture and say, what have I got? Okay. So I've got two types of bones I'm going to pass around for you all to take a look at. This is, I've got a combination of a real bone and a plastic bone. I'd like you to be able to feel the difference. So when you feel the real bone has a not plastic feel to it, right? Okay. The real bone is actually more lightweight, and if you feel the ends, you can actually feel the spongy bone poking through. When I'm feeling the shaft of these two, they feel almost identical. But this plastic bone actually is a tad bit heavier. So the only way to differentiate between these two is to feel around and slight more lightweight feel to it. And then, of course, the spongy bone is poking through on the real bone. Let's see over here. You've got a real humerus. And I want you to feel for that spongy bone on the ends of the bone. So that's kind of what adds to the lightweight texture of these real bones. So to avoid confusion, let's see. This humerus is a real bone, and the ulna is plastic. Just for comparison, you can feel the weight, the texture of those two. And then of these two, the radius is real, and this ulna is fake. Okay, so I just wanted you to have an opportunity. Both ulnas are fake. So most of the time what we have in lab are fake plastic bones. They are better for withstanding, you know, stress. I mean, imagine hundreds of people per semester coming through and touching them. They do get dropped on the floor. The plastic ones aren't going to chip and crack and wear off, but those real bones eventually do chip, crack, and the pieces expose from those. So what we're going to do is take a look at typical long bone structure, and I'm going to start you by naming the shaft of the bone as what? Diaphysis, right. Let's name the shaft of your bone. That's number one on the top of page 65. Let's call it number one, the diaphysis. This diaphysis is a hollow portion of your long bone. On the inside is a hollow cavity known as the medullary cavity. If that medullary cavity houses yellow marrow, the only job is to store tissue, okay? So if it's red marrow by chance, that's when we make what?
Blood,
yeah, make blood cells. So the marrow cavity on the inside is actually a hollow cavity. That hollow cavity stores bone marrow. Now that bone marrow may be yellow in nature or red in nature. If it's yellow, the function is to store fatty tissue or adipose tissue. If red, the function is to make blood cells. We call that hematopoiesis. Now, the inside of the marrow cavity is lined with a type of simple squamous epithelium, and it's called the endosteum. Okay, so that is spelled out there in 1B. Okay, so endosteum is the lining on the inside of that marrow cavity. That's 1B. Number two is periosteum. Thinking about these words, endosteum means inside the bone. What does periosteum mean? Around the bone. Good. So it's outside. It is directly anchored to the underlying bone tissue. So I'd like to show you some periosteum. You can see that it's very tightly anchored to the underlying bone. In fact, it's anchored using these types of fibers called Sharpie's fibers. If you've ever walked in a parking lot on a hot summer day and accidentally stepped on someone else's chewing gum, you probably pulled your shoe up and said a couple of unchoice words, right? And you see these strings of chewing gum coming from your shoe to the pavement. And no matter how far you stretch your shoe away trying to get it off, those fibers anchor your shoe to the chewing gum. That's exactly how Sharpie's fibers work. They grow through the periosteum and into the underlying bone tissue. It is meant for that periosteum to stay anchored, and there's not meant to be any separation of the two. It is to that periosteum that ligaments will anchor, okay, and tendons will anchor. And if you happen to get the periosteum to separate, you can actually lose connection between your muscle and your bone or another bone. So it's critical that that periosteum stay very tightly anchored to the underlying tissue. There are also osteoblasts and osteoclasts that grow and live in this bone, the surrounding bone tissue. The periosteum is home to these bone-forming cells called osteoblasts. What do osteoclasts do for a living?
Break down
and destroy bone. Good. So you can see that after you reach your adult years, that's where the bone growth actually takes place. Let's see, number three on your list is for the epiphysis. Number three is for the term epiphysis. So if we're looking for the epiphysis, we're looking for the ends of the bone. So let's take the humerus for just an example. If we're talking about the proximal epiphysis, proximal means where? Closer to the point of attachment. So the head up here is going to be where your proximal epiphysis is located. The distal epiphysis is further from the point of attachment. That's down here where the trochlea, capitulum, olecranon fossa is located. So if we're talking about maybe someone having broken his or her elbow and it's in the distal epiphysis, that's just generic language to say that it's on that particular end of the bone. So we can use those terms instead of having to be specific with bone markings if we want to talk about one end of the bone versus the other. Now inside each epiphysis, you'll notice there's a lot of spongy bone there. That's the stuff that's very open and needle-like on those real bones being passed around. The compact bone surrounds that spongy bone and helps to reduce friction because it is also coated with another kind of connective tissue. By the way, that is number four. Articular cartilage covers the ends of our bones. Number four is articular cartilage. So that articular cartilage is great for reducing friction in our joints. It does coat and cover the epiphyses. You don't have articular cartilage anywhere else. The term articular implies joint cartilage. Most of the time, it's hyaline. So, obviously, real or not, there's no articular cartilage left on these examples here. But if you've messed with chicken meat before, you know that the ends of the bones, I know, you'll never eat chicken again, right? Those ends are, of course, covered with articular cartilage. We call it gristle, so that's that stuff at the ends of the bones. All right, number five is called the epiphyseal plate. Number five is epiphyseal plate. And number six is epiphyseal line. Number five is the plate. Number six is the line. Which one is made up of growing hyaline cartilage? The plate, yeah. So we sometimes call it a growth plate. It is in the epiphyses of our bones. So does that mean it's along the shaft or at the ends of our bones? At the ends, right. So when our bones are growing up until our middle teenage years, we see our bones grow longer. And then after, I say, age 18 to 20, 21, our epiphyseal plates are going to start to harden because osteoblasts catch up with them. So by the time you're in your middle 20s, we no longer have actively dividing cartilage. We actually have epiphyseal lines. What does the line indicate? You're done growing, yeah. So this picture here shows plates. This person can actively grow taller, but of course you're right. When you no longer have those plates, the lines indicate that you're no longer going to grow any taller. The only growth you can do at that point is appositional or growth in width. By the way, the picture there is a guarantee for the test. Okay, it's a multiple choice setup. That one, your course pack. And I just wanted to draw your attention to the letters. They do correspond with the information that we just covered. So I wanted to ask before we leave today, do you have questions on that picture or its labels? If you do have questions, let's start with that on Wednesday. We'll also start with page 66 on Wednesday.